Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Jodie Goodacre. Jodie is a mental health campaigner with lived experience of anorexia, autistic ADHD, and CRPS. Jodie is passionate about the intersectionality of eating disorder research resulting from her experience of illness, treatment, and recovery. Jodie has worked and volunteered in the mental health sector since 2000, and her advocacy work spans online platforms, schools, workplaces, governments, conferences, and international work with the OECD. She currently volunteers with the Dump the Scales campaign, supporting the all-party parliamentary group for eating disorders. In this week's episode, we talk about Jodie's lived experience of an eating disorder and CRPS, neurodivergence, and other mental health conditions she's experienced. We talk all about how her own personal experience has led her to be so passionate about supporting others and the Dump the Scales campaign. Just before you listen to the episode, I would like to say that Jodie and I will be at the Dump the Scales March on the 21st of June. So if you'd like to come along, please drop us a message and we can send you more details. You can also find details in the show notes. We hope to see you there. I also just want to note that Jodie shares her experience of an eating disorder, suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, and her inpatient stay in hospital. This may be difficult to listen to, so I just wanted to pop a little note before the episode starts so that you can have an awareness of what we're going to be speaking about today. Amazing. Well, Jodie, it's so nice to have you on the podcast. I normally have a little bit of anxiety when I'm doing a podcast when it's somebody that I haven't really met before, but today I'm just speaking to one of my friends, so I'm very happy to have you here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. It's nice to finally be on the podcast. It's been years in the making, it seems.
Yeah, it's so funny as well, because like when we met in London, when we went to Parliament, it was like we met for the first time. But obviously we paraded through London together with a sign, but like classic us, we were both just so overwhelmed by the march, we didn't really even like communicate with.
We were next to each other, we weren't even like the other side of the sign, next to each other, just just focusing on what we had to do.
Exactly. Well, do you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
So I'm Jodie. I'm a mental health campaigner, currently working on the Dump the Scales campaign. Had years kind of working both voluntary and professionally in the mental health sector, and I've had to take quite a bit of time out due to my own personal experience with an eating disorder, which is, what I'm here to talk to you today about, and a bit about kind of future stuff with the Dump the Scales campaign and where we're heading.
No, and I'm very excited to hear about, well, I guess I say hear about, but I know what's happening with the Dump the Scales campaign because I'm working on it with you, but I'm excited to share that with everybody. But I guess maybe it would make sense if we started with your own journey, and if you wanted to share a bit about, you know, your own experience with an eating disorder.
So for me, it's only been in the kind of last couple of years that I've noticed that actually my experience with an eating disorder goes back further than I kind of originally thought. And a lot of that for me was around kind of internal stigma, and just like lacking the validation of what I was going through. Looking back, I would say, I've always had difficulty with body image, and around my body, and I kind of dismissed my relationship with food and exercise for a long time. And when I was really young, I think I got away with it and kind of went under the radar because my behaviours were seen as normal in society. A lot of sport, that was kind of my main focus, was sport, everything, which is great. And like a lot of the time I loved it and I enjoyed it. I loved being part of it. But there were times where it kind of got a bit mangled into why I was doing it. Was I doing it for the love of the game, or was I doing it to change something about myself? And I think I got slightly more mixed up the older I got. But yeah, I think it's hard because a lot of the time I was living in a body that was deemed healthy. My behaviours might not have been. However, from the outside, everything looked great. I was performing well. And that's kind of all that mattered to people around me at the time, because that's what I was good at. And I felt that if I was good at something, I mean, that's all the motivation you need, really, is you've got the external validation there, like, you're great at this. So I'm like, okay, this is the thing that I'll put everything into, and I'm getting support for doing it. So why would I stop at that point? This is kind of more teenage years. I think when I was younger, I'd say maybe like 6 or 7, actually, with sport. I started with like gymnastics and dance classes. And I noticed by the time I was 8 or 9, I had to stop because of the concern around my body, because it was an individualized sport. So I felt like there was so much focus on my body that I just could not tolerate that anymore. I started to really notice the space that my body took, like within the group setting that we were in, that other people's bodies were smaller, and I just could not cope with that anymore. So I moved into team sport, and that was much more for me. But to think back at such a young age that I was noticing my body in the space, now it's like, that's really sad if I think about a kid that young feeling that way. And then when I was 14, I'd experienced an injury, and for me, sport was like everything. I don't know how to truly like emphasize like how much it was. It was like from the moment I woke up in the morning to the moment I went to bed, it was everything. I wanted to go into like professional sports, but at 14 I had an injury that was due to overuse, which again is because of the excessive exercise. But at that age, I didn't really know how to take care of my body, especially with sport, because it was seen as good to be so active. But this injury was something that I thought would be short term, but this ends up being a lifelong thing. And here I am 15 years later, still with the same condition. So it's called complex regional pain syndrome. And it was about 9 months after the original injury that I found out that actually this wasn't going to heal. This was the lifelong thing. It meant that no to sport, no to football. That was my main thing. And I was told in a way that was very, it was just very blasé, like it didn't really matter that they were telling a 14-year-old sports mad kid that that career was over, but also you're going to be in pain for life. From that, my mental health like deteriorated rapidly. I began self-harm. I was really suicidal. I stepped back from my social groups because a lot of those were to do with sport. And suddenly I didn't feel like I belonged in that space either. So I didn't know where I really fit in with the world. And because of kind of the mix of conditions that I had physically, I was on quite a lot of medication. And I was bedbound with depression. So my weight was changing, and it was changing quite rapidly, which, yeah, I couldn't cope very well with. And my coping strategy tended to be go for a run just to get outside and a bit of like blood pumping through me. But I'd lost my coping strategy, and I suddenly had this huge disconnect from my own body. I say about like the body positivity stuff, if we do like meditation that's focused on the body, I couldn't do that because my body is in so much pain that if I focus on my body, I just get more and more sad. And to me, it's like my body is failing me. So I don't owe my body anything back because it's not doing for me what I want and what I need it to do. And I struggled, yeah, a lot. And I still do with like the coming to terms with being disabled. There was a lot of focus on my body anyway, pre-injury, because I was so sporty. My body was different to other girls my age. So I'd have like bigger leg muscles. And I was okay with that because it was serving the purpose that I wanted it to serve. But suddenly I've got the body, but without anything to use it for. I'd started to struggle to eat in front of people because in my head, it was the external, or what I felt was coming from external people, with if they saw me eating something, whether that be something that society deems healthy, in my head, people would be thinking, who is she kidding? If it was something that society deemed to be unhealthy, the view in my head would be like, well, obviously that's why she is the way she is. So it got to a point where I was like, okay, well, I just won't have anything because then there could be no judgment. And I know that there's other factors that I've learned further down the line that would have influenced that experience. So it's hard to kind of, there's a lot of what ifs. What if someone noticed sooner that I was struggling? What if I'd, and I know obviously you know this, that I've since been diagnosed with ADHD and autism. What if they were known when I was younger? Would that have changed things? And it's hard, it is hard to look back on not knowing if something could have changed and the trajectory of where my life has kind of ended up would have changed. And it wasn't until university that things really kicked off again for me. I'd ended up in an abusive relationship for a while. And I think it's the same level of like disconnect to my body, similar to with the chronic pain, is that I hated my body. Thinking about my body reminded me of really traumatic things. And I wanted it to change. It didn't matter how I did it. I just needed to take up less space in the world. And not even necessarily just my body, but just my whole sense of being. I wanted to kind of hide away, not be seen, because I felt it felt safer that if I was more invisible to the world, that I could not be hurt. So one of my first, I would say, major episodes that was never actually logged as an episode of anything, because when it happened, I was at a much higher weight and would have been, if we're looking at the BMI, would have been in like within the obese category. And what happened, I was physically unwell, and I was like, it was physical to start with, where I'd had like a sickness bug, and something there just switched in my brain that I'd had plenty of sickness bugs in the past, but this one for some reason just suddenly caused a severe like panic and fear of food. And I just couldn't eat again, because I was worried every time that I'd be sick. And I'd had investigations galore to try and work out what was going on, because in my head I was like, well, it's definitely physical. And the doctors were saying the same, like there must be something physical going on. And I think that's largely, they were probably looking at my body at the time and be like, well, it's obviously physical. Like, why suddenly can she not eat? Why can't she be around food? Why is she so scared of it? And I'd lost a lot of weight, but it was celebrated, like really celebrated, because I was now in a healthy body. And so from the outside, I looked so much better. I was well. People thought I'd done a lot of hard work. Really, I was in bed for months. Like, I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. I was severely depressed. I'd not left uni, but I'd not turn up to any lectures in second year, which wasn't really noticed again, because I could do enough by like sending an email here and there. Eventually had to repeat the year, but no one really was that concerned by it, even doctors and stuff. Like, because I have other mental health issues, I was under my community adult services. So I had my psychiatrist regularly, and obviously he was seeing it. It was never flagged, because it looked like I was just doing well. But it got to a point where the physical turned into a mental side of things. Like, I noticed that I was starting to feel that elation if I weighed myself. I was starting to really enjoy the praise and the validation of what my body was becoming. It kind of ignited, I mean, I'm a sportsman at heart, and it ignited that like competitive nature in me. It's like, oh, well, I've done this, then I might as well keep going. Like, if this is the way to do it, this is the way to do it. And I wasn't really thinking any differently of it. And at the time, yeah, I just kind of like lapped up the praise of like, yeah, I'm in a healthy body now. This is great. I feel more comfortable. I feel more confident. But realistically, the behaviors that I was doing weren't any different to a later point that ended me up in hospital. So I think a lot of the campaigning I do is around like the weight bias. And it's something internally I still struggle with, I think, because of a lot of my own experiences of being at different points within my own body and knowing how that was treated, because I've seen it from both sides within myself. So it can be really, really confusing. I thought I was doing the right thing, that it was like the healthy thing, it's what people wanted. It's still really confusing to look back on, because it wasn't diagnosed as an eating disorder then, but I know now myself, having done more work, having had like more therapy, more understanding, even like going into campaigning specifically for eating disorders and the research involved in that, it's like, whoa, that was an eating disorder. It's just that my body looked differently, and that's why it wasn't picked up. And I mean, it not being picked up is one thing, but it being celebrated, like, that's a whole other thing. And to be honest, I'm not really sure what changed, because things were stable again for a little while. And it wasn't until for like 2017, 2018, after I kind of got out of that relationship, that I ended up in like a really bad depressive episode again. It wasn't so much like food related, it was more like trauma related, just couldn't function in society. The next episode wasn't for a few years later, and I'd started work at a mental health campaign, and it was the same thing again, that I had had a sickness bug, and because of my past experience, I panicked straight away. And I think the fact that there was fear immediately was a concern, and it had only been about 3 weeks from there that I actually went to the GP. So it was very, very early before things escalated and said, like, look, this is my experience in the past, this is the way I feel right now, this is kind of like where my mental health is at. I work kind of in the sector, I know the signs. Like, I was more educated at this point. I was like, I know the signs, I'm concerned that this is going to be a slippery slope. And what I got from the GP then, again, weight wise, you're at a healthy weight, you've got plenty of wiggle room, so I wouldn't worry about losing weight. And that is like, yeah, that one has stuck with me, because it's always like, you've got wiggle room, like, what, come back in 6 months when there isn't wiggle room anymore. Because I was basically being told, you weigh too much to be coming and wasting my time with concerns around your eating. And in a way, it was her saying, like, actually, this might be good for you. That would have been January 2019. And I carried on working for a while. Things were getting worse. And my manager had noticed, and she said, like, look, things clearly aren't great with you. Something's not right. Why don't you take 2 weeks off, come back afterwards, have a bit of a reset. It's like, brilliant. Because I knew myself that I wasn't working the way that I wanted to work. I was, well, I mean, not showing up to work more and more. I was kind of doing work from home, but not really working from home. A lot of my behaviors revolved around walking and the numbers involved in that. I'd turn up to the office and I'd be taking breaks at least once an hour. I'd disappear and I'd just be up and down the stairs. And obviously over time, they start noticing that I'm not at my desk. No one really said anything. And because no one said anything, I was like, I'm getting away with this. And because I was getting away with it, I was like, let me try and push the boundary a little bit more, until she eventually said, like, look, like, you're not in trouble. We're just noticing like something's not right. Take some time. Right. Okay. And in my head, I was like, I can take this time and I can go full force on my behaviors, because I now don't have to work. I don't have to worry about that. And on the day that I was due back to go to work, I'd had a seizure as a result of the eating disorder. So that was my last day at work. I didn't return, and I'd had a difficult departure, I would say, from work, in that I'd been there for years, and suddenly it was kind of like the ties felt like they were cut. I just, all of a sudden, I was working there and then I wasn't, and that was it. Because I had a seizure as a result of the eating disorder behaviors that were going on. And I think it was then that doctors maybe started to take notice. And I'd say, like, at this point, again, my weight was healthy. So from being told there was wiggle room, actually, like, these sort of consequences aren't just for people that are underweight. I was at a healthy weight at this point, but because of what I was doing to my body, like, it couldn't cope.
And it might be a healthy weight on a scale, but yeah. Just doesn't mean it's a healthy weight for you.
Yeah. And also, like, health, like, that's another thing, like, with healthy weight, like, a healthy weight could actually be what they class as overweight.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, there's a lot of mixed, like, I'm not a big fan of, like, the whole BMI system, especially within eating disorders treatment. But yeah, I think I was still in a lot of denial at the time because of, like, the constant messaging that I'd had from, well, healthcare professionals, not just like society, like people that are actually in position, that are trained, that are qualified, that I thought had done the adequate training to help someone. They were praising it. They were telling me it's not bad enough, not to worry. And then a seizure happened. I was like, hang on a minute. Like, why did that happen? And I still don't really know why, but my body is healthy. They're telling me that it's okay. So why can't I just continue? And at that point, they'd taken away my driver's license because I'd had a seizure, which then only ramped up the walking side of things, because like, I use that car for independence. You've taken that away from me. So it's like, well, how do I get from A to B? It probably, I'd say it made things worse, but they have to do that, of course, like in terms of safety. I couldn't drive anywhere if there was a risk of another seizure. So they decided to put me into like a day patient unit. And I was there for, well, it would have been at 6 weeks, but it wasn't a eating sort of specialist one. It was just like a general psychiatric day patient. Because they were like, we don't know what to do with you, essentially. Like, something's not right, but we don't have the resources to treat you. This was from, it's been the crisis team that sent the referral to day patient, and it felt like a dumping ground. If it was specialized, I think, again, like, it's another what if, like, could I have got more from it? But this was very much a case of, we don't know what to do with you, go sit in a room with people that other teams also don't know what to do with them, have some lessons about general mental health, which might be helpful for some people. And like, they were like educational sessions, don't get me wrong. However, having worked in the field and done a lot of it, it felt like sessions that I've done in the past that I've delivered. So I didn't get anything from it. I just felt more and more distressed. It felt patronizing. And then I wasn't sleeping either, because I then felt that I had to make up for the lost time that I'd been stuck in all day. Therefore, I'm going to have to spend all night to try and make up for what I'd missed. Like, it just made my head worse than it was before I went in. And I think they knew that. And so I finally got a referral to an eating disorder service. But my first time in the service, it was horrendous, really invalidating. It wasn't accessible to me because obviously I'd lost the car. So now I was spending 2 hours each way on a bus to get to an appointment for 15 minutes. And I wasn't well enough to be doing that, but I had to do it, because I knew that I had to engage, and I was lucky to be able to get an appointment. But I'd get there and I'd be taken into a corridor. So not a separate room. It was in the corridor. There was a scales. Stand on that. You have your weight measured. Happy days. Off you go. And I was like, what is the point of doing this every week? But I still did it, because the consultant I had, I'm not really sure what's going through her head, but every time she praised me, after I got weighed, and I know now, obviously, it wasn't going in the right direction. However, she kept saying, brilliant, going in the right direction. I'm like, well, you've clearly not checked the previous weight, but it felt to me that because my weight might have been higher than other people within the service, that she was like, well, this is a brilliant weight. But I was taking it like, she didn't care that I was maybe losing weight. So it became another goal. I was like, right, well, I'll see you again next week. It literally became like a Weight Watchers session within an eating disorders team. And I was like, this is like, now obviously I know, I'm like, that's horrendous. Like, that never should have happened. But at the time, I was like, well, see you again next Friday for the same thing. I had a dietitian, was awful. She called maybe like twice and would just tell me to eat more. Didn't specify anything, just, you need to eat more. It's like, okay, I don't know how to do that, because my brain is like telling me that this is the wrong thing to do, and you're just telling me to eat more. And I had one therapy session where I was told, I'm not the right therapist for you, and this isn't the therapy that is most suited to you. However, I'm in your area, so we thought we'd just tick it off. I was like, oh my God, like, you've said like that quite a bit out loud, that it's just a tick box thing. And I was like, okay, look, I'll play ball. I've kind of navigated the system for quite some time. I know how to deal with it. And I just turn up, say what you need me to say, and move on. And then suddenly, like, the appointment letters just stopped coming. was like, I don't really know what's going on. Because before that, I was getting like the scare tactics, like, this will happen to you, this will happen to you. And I was like, I don't care. And that was like where my gut was at the time. And I struggle with like chronic suicidality anyway. So the scare tactics really just did not work. And then suddenly, yeah, the appointment letters stopped coming. And I found out a few months later that the reason for that was because I was disengaged. So they discharged me. But there was no conversation with me about that. You'd think like they'd have a conversation to say like, we've noticed maybe that you're not engaging so much, but nothing. And I'm still confused by that, because to me, I was traveling 4 hours on a round trip for a 15-minute appointment. I didn't miss an appointment, at least from like what I can remember. Like possibly I forgot something, but for me, I was like, I didn't miss any appointments. I went to them, I hated them, I didn't find them helpful, but I was engaged, like I was engaged in the sense that I was turning up.
But quote unquote disengaged, surely that is a sign that you need further support, not that you know, if somebody knows anything about eating disorders, it's that when people are at their most severe, it is when they are disengaged from treatment. They do not want to go to appointments. Yeah. You know, the fact that you're turning up, you know, that's fantastic. But, you know, to say you're disengaged is so dismissive of what you were going through. And I think that just completely shows the lack of awareness. And honestly, mate, I just, from what you're saying, I can't believe the way that your treatment, or, well, it's not even been treatment, let's be real, the way that things have gone, because it literally just every time you say something, I'm like, how can this get any worse?
Stay tuned. Yeah, like you say, like what with the disengaged, I really struggle with that as an excuse for poor treatment. They should be asking like, okay, why is that person disengaged? What are the barriers? Are we an accessible service? Like, what is it that's stopping this person engaging rather than just cutting them off?
Yeah, like a naughty child. And even if you were a naughty child, you know, my answer would not be just say to you, oh, you're naughty, therefore we're going to abandon you. It's like, is something going on here that's, you know, making you act in this way or what have you? Particularly in eating disorder treatment, where, you know, I've said this 1,000 times on the podcast, unfortunately, people with eating disorders aren't very grateful for their treatment in the moment because you're asking them to do the thing that is the biggest fear in the whole entire world. Yes, if they get to the point where they recover years down the line, they may come back to you and say that they're grateful. But most people aren't going to get to that point, or they're not, you know, hopefully they get to that point, but most people aren't going to come back to the hospital and thank you for their treatment. So unfortunately, that is part of the issue, I guess, with being a clinician that works in eating disorders. Most people are going to be, you know, pretty disengaged or what have you, because they don't want to be doing it. It's their biggest fear.
Yeah. I mean, like when I was in hospital, some of my behaviours towards some of the staff there, like, I would never dream of doing that to anyone. Mm. Like kicking, screaming, throwing food at them. Like that's not exactly an engaged patient, but it's like so distressing. And to have medical trauma on top of it, where you're being told that you're disengaged, we're going to abandon you, for people that already feel on the whole quite worthless, to then be dropped by the people that are meant to be the ones that are caring for them. It's a case of like, okay, well, if the eating disorders services can't handle me for an eating disorder, who will? Like, where do I go from here? And for me, like, I then, like, really went downhill. I can't even remember like, when that would have been. It must have been still 2019 that I was disengaged. And I got back, like, drinking. I'd been sober for quite a while. I stopped drinking because I noticed, like, my relationship with alcohol wasn't healthy, and it was largely to do with my mental health. But I'd started drinking again, like excessively, to kind of deal with the eating sort of thoughts, but also as a way to like socialize and try and have some relationship with friends, because I couldn't eat with them anymore. So I thought, I can drink alcohol. And from that, I gained a bit of weight. So then the team, like the mental health team, started to think that I was recovering. And I was like, whoa, no, what's happening here is I'm abusing substances as a way to cope. But again, it's missed, because all they see is the weight. And I've had that throughout my life, where my weight has been used as like the determining factor as to whether my mental health is good or not. And usually they get it wrong. Yeah, tough. And then, well, what we end of 2019, now so 2020, COVID hits. And like for everyone, the world like kind of, it just imploded. It accelerated everything massively. There was kind of the lack of access to safe foods. There was being stuck at home. And for me, it wasn't a safe environment. So it made things worse. I was having to be outside the house more, and things were deteriorating rapidly to the point that I then had another seizure. And this time there was a lot more damage done, because unlike previously, where I'd have been deemed to be a healthy weight, I was now underweight, and I'd fractured my back as a result of landing like hard surface. And I remember my little brother found me, and that caused a huge, like, excuse the pun, fracture in our relationship, because he would have only been about 16 at the time, and he was like terrified. And looking back now, I know how terrified he was, and having to like pick his big sister up off the floor, who, like, I spent a lot of time raising him. So suddenly the roles had reversed, and he was like trying to drag him off the floor. And I kept that quiet, because at the time I knew, I was like, this is quite serious. I am going to get in trouble here, in terms of, well, what I thought was day hospital again. I was like, oh, they're going to send me back to day hospital. Like, I can't do that again. It was like horrendous. And I got away with it for a while because the services were all kind of like shut down for COVID. They couldn't see anyone. And it was only because my care co at the time was like, do you know what? No, we can't do this. Let's go for like a walk and talk, be outside, be distance, but I need to have some face-to-face engagement with you. And she obviously saw the way that I was moving. She was like, this is not your usual pain walk. This is a different pain walk. And I kind of said like, oh, I sort of fractured my back, in a very like blasé way that's like, oh, everyone fractures their back, it's normal. And she was like, whoa, 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 take a step back here. Like, what happened? And I was like, oh, I had another seizure, but don't worry, like, I feel okay now. And she was like, oh, we're gonna have to escalate this. And I was like, not day patient. I was like, I can't do that again, it's pointless. I've told you, it didn't help me. I can't do it again, I can't do it again. And I was like, if it's a specialist day patient, maybe, but don't send me back to that place. And she's like, I think we're past that. And I was like, right, okay, like, just let's stop talking about it. And then I've got called in to the unit. I was like, you're doing appointments again. And to my surprise, I was bombarded by a mental health team. I was like, okay, what's happening? And I get the element of surprise now, because I wouldn't have turned up. But she suddenly turned around and was like, we're gonna have to section you. I was like, hang on a minute, like, I thought I was just coming in for the usual like talk. What is happening here? I was on my own, didn't know, like, I didn't understand what my rights were at this point. And then she started going on about doing NG feeds and like just throwing loads of things at me. And I was completely overwhelmed. I was like, nothing was actually going in. And I don't know if I would have asked someone to come with me if I was told or not, but I was on my own. They were deeming that I didn't have mental capacity. I wasn't taking in anything they were saying. So it didn't really matter what they said to me. All I heard was hospital. And I went into like worst case scenario, and wanted to just run. And then the next day I was told like, it's a waiting list. I was like, right, okay. And that went on and on and on. I think it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks later that I finally got a date to go into hospital. But those 3 weeks were probably like the worst 3 weeks that I've been, because I knew that it was coming, but I didn't know when. It was a fear of the unknown that was mixed among all of it. And I felt like I had to do everything I could before I went into hospital, which was then, yeah, I was in hospital for a year. I don't actually even know where to begin describing that experience. Because it happened again, it was during COVID. So it's very different to what the experience might have been pre or after COVID. Because we were in lockdown, like, we weren't allowed to leave the grounds, we weren't allowed visitors. It was really, really tough. First day, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's funny to look back on now, but one of my behaviors was laxatives, and that's not spoken about very much. It's like not particularly nice, none of it's very nice, but I'd like overdone it because I was like fearful that they were going to take it away. I didn't know that the bathrooms and stuff were locked, because you're not told that before you go into hospital. So the first day was an absolute shit show. literally. And I became like really close with the HCA that was with me at the time. But I was like, oh, what a first impression. What a first impression. This is horrible. Everything was so overwhelming. No one told you anything. You're just kind of like, you turn up, you do an assessment, dumped in the room, and then immediately get punished and threatened with different course of actions because you're disengaging. And I was like, I don't know why I'm disengaging, because no one's told me. Again, this would be like potentially links with the autism side of things, but no one's told me what the rules are here, and I'm being told that I'm non-compliant. I was like, I don't know what I'm meant to be complying with, because no one's told me. So yeah, I mean, the first couple of months were particularly like brutal. You're thrown in a new environment. I didn't know what was going on most of the time. I felt like I was being punished constantly. Obviously, looking back, I'm like, it was the meal plan. It's what they have to do. Like, there's no other option. But the way it was done sometimes, I think, could have been changed. And again, if they knew about, I didn't even know then, to be fair, about like whether there was like autism and ADHD involved. I had no understanding. I just thought like, that's just the way I am, and that's how I kind of function in the world. And because I'd had so many different labels thrown on me, I was like, well, it's got to be one of those things that are causing all of this. That there's a lot of things that I needed to do for like sensory wise that I was punished for doing or asking to do, because they're like, well, that's your eating disorder voice. I was like, I don't think it is, because I did this before the eating disorder. And they're like, well, we don't know that. Therefore, you have to do this, because we have to treat you all the same, otherwise it will cause problems. I'm like, to an extent, I understand how it can cause problems, because there was a lot of competition between people. There was a lot of arguments that took place and uproar if one person got treated differently. But also, we are all individuals. Yes, we all have eating disorders, but we all have slightly different behaviours. We all come from different backgrounds. Like, there's an extent that you do need to treat people as individuals if you want the best outcome. Otherwise, it's a case of like a one-stop, quickly try and weight restore you and get you to a physically safe situation before putting you in the community. Or are you actually trying to treat the person's eating disorder? Because a lot of the time it felt like they weren't actually trying to treat the mental illness. It was a case of, we'll treat the physical symptoms and off you go. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think from what you've said so far about what your experience, you know, it doesn't make sense to me that that's how somebody would look to treat an eating disorder. But in the respect of how every single other element of your treatment had been so weight focused, you know, it makes sense that all they thought that needed to happen was to weight restore, and that, yeah, you needed to do that in the same way possible. And, you know, I totally get it that I've personally not been on an inpatient unit myself, but I can imagine that they are extremely difficult environments, because eating disorders thrive on comparison. And so, you know, you're all going to be comparing yourself to each other. That makes sense. So I can understand why they're like, we can't treat anybody differently. But naturally, in order to recover, you need the support that is supportive to your own journey. And that is going to be different to the person next to you. So yes, I you know, I can completely understand it's a very difficult thing to manage, but also an eating disorder is a really difficult thing to live with and recover from. So it's not going to be easy. Yeah,
no. I think that's it. They want a quick fix. They want the cheapest, quickest fix possible to kind of like, obviously like the waiting lists are huge as well. So it's like they need to get one person out to get another person in. And I thought, I don't know, I was naive, but I thought I'd be maybe like a month or two and then I'd be able to get out. And that kind of month went by. And I was like, right, second month went by. And the longer it got, I was like, it feels like there's no end in sight. It's like, what do I have to do to like please you? It's like, how do I do this right, in the right way that allows me to get out? And again, it was me trying to like navigate the system in a way that I thought that, in a way that I thought they wanted. So that I could get out and get back to my life. But yeah, time went on and I'd started to weight restore, started to have some therapy, but because of COVID, everything was like all over the place. Some of the therapy took place in the bedrooms because there was no space, like we couldn't go out, and there was no transition really from hospital life to the outside world because it was lockdown. We couldn't, like, there was nothing we could do. But I'd say, like, I probably picked up. I did, I weight restored in hospital, and I have continued along that path since I was discharged. So obviously something worked, but I don't think it was hospital. It was the therapy that I had after hospital, more so, because hospital just gave me a whole load more trauma. It was, again, like the non-compliance stuff, just the constant state during meal times. We'd have issues with staffing levels that people didn't understand what was going on. If you had bank staff or agency staff that come in without even reading like a brief overview of what eating disorders are, it could be like really dangerous on the ward. And the more I weight restored, the worse I felt mentally, which I know is kind of like something that does happen in recovery, that you, if you're so malnourished, sometimes it can kind of block the emotions, and they suddenly started hitting me like never before. And I'd expressed that I was suicidal, and all that happened was I was threatened to be discharged to a, well, kind of discharged, but moved to a general psychiatric hospital because they can't deal with that. And I was like, this is actually the reality for a lot of people with weight restoration, and it's a lot, like a lot of people with eating disorders do struggle with suicidality. Like, you need to have some compassion to be able to deal with that. But instead it was kind of ignored. There was instances of harm within the unit that weren't dealt with particularly well. And in my experience, I was able to make an attempt on my life within the hospital environment that's meant to be a safe, that it's not always safe. And things need to change within that environment. And I wasn't able to talk to staff about it, because every time I had done beforehand, it was a case of like, well, we'll have to get rid of you to a psychiatric unit. And the fear of that was then like, well, they can't deal with eating disorders at all. So like, what do I do then? And it just made me like, yeah, go into a complete spiral. And I was desperate to get out, but I had no care coordinator at this point because mine had left and they hadn't found a new one. So I had CPAs with absolutely no one attending. It was just hold music. And this happened for months. And I don't know why they still let me sit in them, to be honest, because I just had to sit there and listen to hold music. And I was like, this is awful. All this is doing, you're making me sit here. So firstly, I mean, hold music is horrendous. I can't deal with that anyway. But you're making me sit here and listen to the fact that no one gives a shit. Like, no one cares. No one's waiting for me on the outside. So what is the point of all of this? Why am I doing, like, why am I following the meal plan if there's nothing waiting for me? And that was really, like, a really, really low point, because I no longer felt like I had something to fight for. And they were kind of reinforcing that by organizing meetings and making me sit through them without having confirmation that anyone was going to attend. Yeah, I mean, what do you do with that? So I felt like I was kept in there. It felt like a punishment because they couldn't find staff on the outside to coordinate my care. So I was kept in there for longer than I needed to be. And I'd weight restored to a point that they said that I could go, but there was no one waiting on the outside. So then I started to go backwards and like regress, and things started to deteriorate. I was able, well, I was restricting in hospital and they didn't really care at this point. So like, well, we got you to where you need to be. And then it was going backwards. And I was being treated like I was a staff member most of the time, because I'd been there for a while, that people kind of ended up relying on me to sort things. And because I struggle, I mean, this is a case of across my life, like I struggle when I can see things going like so poorly, and I'm like, all you need to do is just like change that one thing and do that, and then like it'll run smoothly. And the moment I started to do that, the staff became reliant on it, which was helpful in the sense that it gave me a distraction and gave me something to do. But at the same time, I wasn't staff, like I was a patient, and I was,
you are not there to be running the hospital, you are there to get treatment. And the fact that that was even something that was, you know, that you were allowed to do, let alone that actually happened, is just,
yeah, it's, yeah, I don't know, it kind of turned into the fact that I was like just a lodger, really, that, well, I couldn't find rent elsewhere, so I thought I'd just lodge in a hospital room. Because yeah, I was doing stuff that should have been the staff, and I struggle with accepting like the care and help anyway. So at the time, like, it was easy. It was more like I could tolerate it better because I didn't feel like I deserved the help anyway. I was like, other people, like, they're struggling more, so just help them, leave me be. Like, I've got it, I'll do what I need to do. There's quite a bit of negligence going on, and there were some brilliant staff in there that kept me going, but overall the system, like, it just didn't work. And I struggled to constantly see everything that was going on around me, like living for a year, being woken up by alarms, being woken up by people screaming. There is a lot of trauma that takes place. There's a lot of love, there's a lot of community, and it helps a lot of people, but I think we need to hold space for the fact that people come out with a lot of trauma, and that's like across medical settings, unfortunately. So we need like more education, more awareness, in order to be able to like treat people compassionately. Like I said, like I did come out weight restored, but it was like the therapy that I had afterwards that was like made the big difference. I wouldn't say necessarily hospital in terms of mentally, physically, yes, it had prevented me from dying. Mentally, it almost cost me my life again.
And I think that's a really interesting point, because I think that a lot of people would say that that is the role of hospital, is to get you to a point physically where you are stable. Yeah. But that doesn't need to be at the expense of your mental health. And I don't want to like, you know, rush through your story or anything, but I am just aware of like time and stuff. And wondered, like, all that experience, like where you're at now with it, and kind of why that has inspired you to now work with the Dump the Scales campaign.
Yeah, so where I'm at now, I'm still in therapy. I had a year off, but I went into it was a integrated arts therapy, and that's the first time like any kind of therapy has helped me, and it also helped me to understand my neurodivergence. Before that, I had no understanding, and having that now in the picture, having a therapist that sees the whole, like all of me, and not just like, okay, we're treating you for an eating disorder, or we're treating you for depression, we're treating you for the trauma. Having someone that will kind of take away those labels, like, acknowledge them, recognize them, know that they're a part of you, but not treating the label, treating the human, has helped me to gain more insight of myself, where I'm at. And I think my experiences as a whole, and the anger that's kind of built up from it. I've always kind of said, like, within therapy, like, I struggle expressing anger. And I know that you've said the same, like, yourself, but I can't struggle, like, express anger. But actually, like, I am expressing it a lot of the time in a healthy way through campaigning. That all of that experience, all the stuff that I've witnessed and see other people go through, that is a big driver for me. Like, not so much my own experience. I tend to take a step back. Like I said, like, this is the first time that I've kind of spoken about my own experience, because I would prefer to get a platform ready for other people. That has been the driver, is the seeing the harm that's been done to people, seeing the struggle that people are going through, whether it's the wait lists, whether it's the actual treatment itself, whether it's weight bias. Something needs to change, and people are dying. That's the reality. It's not a case of like people are struggling. Yes, but people are dying. People are losing their lives. Something needs to change, because we can't keep going the way that we're going. And so that's kind of, what got me into the Dump the Scale stuff. I've known Hope for what year are we in now? Like, probably going up towards a decade. But that was before, like, with general mental health stuff that I was doing campaigning, and we kind of crossed paths within that sphere. And so I reached out to her and just said, like, look, I kind of want to put my like toe back into campaigning a little bit. How can I help? Is there anything that I can do? Can I use my experience? Is there anything like you need? And then suddenly it went from like dipping a toe to like just throwing myself in the whole pool, and getting like really invested in it. And comes with maybe the ADHD side, like hyperfocus has now become this. And I'm like really passionate about it, and glad that she has expanded the campaign, because obviously it started as a, like, we'll dump the scales, like, ignore the BMI. And actually don't use that as a barrier for people like getting help. And we've had some obviously questions about it. It's like, yeah, of course, sometimes people need to be weighed within eating disorder services. We're not saying that don't weigh people, because that's part of treatment, unfortunately. Like, as much as it's going to be painful for people, it's part of treatment. But what we're saying is, don't let someone's weight rule them out from being treated. Don't judge someone based on their weight. Don't turn someone away because they don't fit the stereotype that you deem to be acceptable for an eating disorder. Because that's then, again, a lot of time very anorexia focused. And that was my experience, but it's not the experience of a lot of people. I think, like, we are, what would I say, like, we're doing a march in June on the 21st. And this is going to be the third march that we've done now. And it's been, I know obviously you've been to them, it's, the community is lovely. Like, it's filled with anger and frustration, again, in a healthy way, to kind of make change happen. People are sharing their experiences with us, and it's heartbreaking. And we are grateful that people come to us to share their vulnerabilities with us in order to make change. And obviously with Hope being secretariat of the APBG for eating disorders now, we've got more of a way in with government directly, which is really, really great to make change. And things are slowly moving, but we know that we're nowhere near done. And that's kind of, again, what the march is going to be. It's another moment to get our voices heard, to get the word out there and beyond people that are kind of within, I say, I don't know how to word it, like, within the eating disorder world. A lot of people will be aware of the march, but we want to kind of get the word out beyond that to try and help change the narrative that there is around eating disorders. And it's always like a real catalyst for change, to get stories in the media and to move away from, like, the stereotypes, to have people in solidarity from whatever background, and speakers to hear from their lived experience. We've got carers, we've got professionals. It's really lovely, like, a combination of people from different angles. I think that's what makes it so special, that you've got people fighting from every corner. I'm really excited.
I think when I went the first time, I remember I went with George, my friend, and I remember I was so nervous, and I was like, oh my God, what is this going to be like? Like, am I going to get triggered? You know, is everyone there going to be really sick? And then, you know, normally when, you know, like we said earlier, when you think of an inpatient ward, you think of that comparison. And I was very, very nervous. And I remember turning up and I was like, oh my God, this is the most supportive group of people ever. And yeah. I mean, you know, from doing the podcast, I absolutely know that, in that it's a sad reality about the reason why we know each other and the reason that we get together and we are so passionate about what we're talking about. However, I remember just speaking to so many people and being like inspired by the courage that they had to share their story, by the passion that they had, the support that they had for other people. There wasn't an inch of comparison, you know. There wasn't like a, I'm sicker than you, therefore I deserve more support, or, you know, my loved one's worse off than you, that sort of thing. It was just, how can we all do this together to make sure that we're all getting the right support that we need? And, you know, I think one thing I've definitely found from when I've spoken to people with lived experiences, not a single person with an eating disorder has ever felt that they're sick enough for treatment.
Yeah.
And that's a really sad reality. But then when you see people, you know, actually up there and advocating for themselves, saying, do you know what? I actually do deserve this treatment and I do deserve more support that I've been given. I think that for me was one of, you know, like, the biggest inspirations. And I remember coming away from that day just feeling so empowered and being like, right, you know, there is a group of people that are so committed to this change. And I was proud to be part of that community. So I think if anyone is listening and thinking, you know, how, like, if I go, am I going to find it really difficult? Am I going to be triggered? You know, there's no guarantees that we can't say that something might be said that, you know, might trigger you. But ultimately, you know, nobody's out there to get you. And actually what my experience was, it was such an incredibly supportive community. And if you are worried about things like, you know, but God, what if I don't know anybody and then there's nobody to talk to?
there absolutely will be somebody to talk to. There'll be so many of us there on the day who will, you know, be there to come up to and to chat to. And Jodie has done absolutely an amazing job at putting all, you know, all information on the Instagram page and all things about accessibility and everything like that. So I guess I just want to say, if you are considering coming to the march but have any kind of worries or concerns, firstly, just reach out to one of us, because we're absolutely happy to chat. But secondly, like, it is such a wonderful group of people that you will leave feeling so connected to other people. It won't be a case of leaving and thinking, I'm on my own in this.
Yeah, 100%. I think what you said about, like, the validation of being, like, the sick enough sort of a fear is that I think for a lot of people that maybe come away from the speeches and think, actually, no, you're right. Like, I do deserve help. And that is, like, a beautiful thing to come away from with, because that was my experience. I heard someone else speak, and that's when I was like, that kind of matches my experience. Mm. And obviously not everyone's experience is going to be the same, but something in those speeches or something at the event might just kind of flick something in your brain to be like, yeah, no, like, I need to reach out. Something needs to change. And also the signs are awesome. Every time, like, I love, like, checking out all the different signs that people have made. Some of them, like, heartbreaking. Some of them, like, got a bit of humour in them. It's just, it's beautiful to see, a sea of signs. Which, yeah, well, I mean, we were worried the first year. We were like, oh, God, what if no one turns up? What if no one turns up? And then, like, the surprise of the community, it's beautiful to be a part of. It's heartbreaking as to why we have to come together. We are very aware of the reality. But it is a lovely event, and obviously slightly biased in that I'm trying to organise it. But it is a lovely community. People are friendly. Like you said, like, there's loads of us that will be around wearing high-vis jackets. So just come and grab one of us if you need anything. Or we've got the email is dumpthescales@gmail.com. Drop a line there. Someone will get back to you. And if you need, like, a buddy system and stuff to create, we have linked people up in the past. Overall, like, it's a great day. I was the same as you, that, like, I was really worried the first year, like, is it gonna be really triggering? But I didn't feel triggered at all during the day. I know, again, some people's triggers are different, but I kind of were like, whoa, that was okay. And I was kind of like surprised in a way, and so more excited for the second year. And this is the third year we're now doing it, so yeah, excited to see what comes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jodie. I appreciate you so much sharing your story. And I know that I'm sure was difficult with it being the first time sharing. But I think it's so important that people do share their story, because I think, you know, it shares the reality of eating disorder services and how people are being treated, and how that is completely not right. So really, really do appreciate that. I'll put all the details for the Dump the Scales March, which is 21st of June this year, 2025, in the show notes. And I'll put the details for Dump the Scales Instagram and email as well, so people can get in contact if they want to reach out. But honestly, thank you so much.
Thank you, my love. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.